Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. In a familiar political ritual, several presidential candidates file their paperwork at the State House for the 2020 New Hampshire primary. Cities hold elections for mayor, and voters decide whether to allow sports betting in their communities. And after public pressure, Concord's high school principal resigns just days after the district's superintendent did the same for their handling of sexual assault allegations against a high school teacher. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today. You can watch it again at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire-based political reporter who writes for Fox News, The Concord Monitor, and Seacoast Online, and Paula Tracy, senior reporter covering State House and environmental issues for InDepthNH.org. She previously worked at the New Hampshire Union Leader for 25 years and for 4 years at WMUR. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Hi, Peter.
So let's start the show with 2020 stuff. Filing for the New Hampshire primary, well-known event in New Hampshire. Paul Steinhauser, though, for anyone unfamiliar with this, explain what's involved.
It's a ritual. As you said, it's gone back generations. The candidate has to come, most usually, but not always, in person. They make that trek down the hallway, the second floor hallway in the historic State House, to the Secretary of State's office. They meet with Bill Gardner, the longest serving Secretary of State in the nation. They sign paperwork. They hand over that check for $1,000. And guess what? They're on the ballot. A lot of the bigger campaigns make sure that their supporters are there. There's usually a cauldron of supporters that the candidate walks through down that long hallway. And then they often have a rally outside the State House after it's all over. It's a lot of pomp, pageantry, but it's also an exciting moment for the candidates and for us in the journal, in the reporting world.
And you said that you don't have to come in person, and that's a good thing, I guess, for President Trump. He sent Mike Pence this week.
He did send Mike Pence this week. We had the vice president here, and of course, you know, it was all about Donald Trump and 2020, but let's also be honest. For Mike Pence, well, there's always 2024, and I think he may, even though he didn't say he had it on his mind, it's good for Mike Pence to come up here to reacquaint himself with people. He made an unannounced stop. Where did he go? The Puritan back room in Manchester. That's a must stop for anybody who's considering running for the White House.
So is this really too soon to talk about 2024, though? I mean, wow.
Yeah, for most people, yes. For political reporters like me, no. But the main show, it was all about 2020.
So, Dean, what do you make
of that? One of the fun things about this ritual of filing for the primary is everybody jams into the office at the counter. It's a very familiar tableau, and you can kind of judge the excitement by how jammed that room is in terms of reporters sometimes standing on the windowsill, and everybody's crowded around Bill Gardner. At this point, given how many years he's been Secretary of State, I wonder how many photos he's posed for with various candidates.
Is there enough wall space for all those photos?
It would be, if you counted up going all the way back to the 70s, a lot of candidates.
Let me tell you how crowded it was for Pence, and it will be that way for Biden when he comes later today. I was jam-packed against the wall. I had people on time. I mean, it was incredible. People had been lined up the press in there for hours to get a little space.
And security, too. Security was beefed up.
Secret Service sweeps, everything. Yeah, for the first time in probably in a while, the State House was basically on lockdown. You had to go through the magnetometers. It was quite a scene.
Streets were closed down, too, for Pence, certainly.
Paula?
Yes, I was on my tippy toes when Sanders was there, crushed up against Paula's desk in the Secretary of State's office. But it was really fun. And I also thought that the group that came to see Amy Klobuchar were particularly enthusiastic. I met this guy, Peter Grote from Franconia. He drove an hour and a half down to see his candidate. And he was saying how he really was excited about her and her pragmatic approach. So it was fun. We've got a couple more days of this and deadlines next week. So we'll see a few more of them through the halls of the State House.
Right. The deadline is Friday, right?
Friday.
A week from today. While he was here, Vice President Mike Pence had a chance to speak publicly, and he took the opportunity to swipe at Democratic candidates.
I think what's most remarkable to me, finally, is that leading candidates in the Democratic Party for President of the United States openly advocate an economic system that has impoverished millions and robbed the liberties of generations in the last century. That system is called socialism.
So a critique of socialism. Paul, are we hearing a preview of the Republicans' main line of attack going forward?
Not even a preview. I mean, that's something that the president, Vice President Pence, and Republicans in general have been lambasting and labeling the Democrats for months into the entire year. And they're trying to, you know, paint the same broad brush for all Democrats, even though it's mostly Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who advocated proposals that some would call socialist. That comment coming from his speech at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, he headlined Politics and Eggs. But, you know, the vice president also up here on a day when his top aide on foreign policy was testifying at the House impeachment inquiry. The vice president took questions from those of us in the media, including NHPR, and he was he pushed back strongly, saying that he had done nothing wrong in the Ukrainian crisis, the president had done nothing wrong, and basically portrayed the whole process as partisan.
Mm-hmm. Other candidates to talk about this week, one of them was Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. She used her visit to the Secretary of State's office to talk about the issues that were important to her. Paul, your thoughts on Tulsi Gabbard?
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard's doing quite well. I mean, surprisingly, you know, she's resonating with an interesting slice of the electorate up here. She's at about 4 or 5% in the latest polls. She also used that filing to once again highlight one of her top issues, which is a push for the White House and the executive branch to release some of these documents from 9/11 regarding Saudi Arabia. So she made a major push on that. But Gabbard just qualified for the next presidential debate. She's got a decent amount of campaign cash on hand, and you know, I don't see her dropping out of the race anytime soon.
Yeah, you know, she got a boost from the whole episode a few weeks ago where Hillary Clinton made some comments about Gabbard being groomed by Russians to potentially do a third-party candidate run a la Jill Stein in the last election, and that in some way could tip the election in favor of Donald Trump. It caused a bit of a furor. There was a big debate on social media about whether Clinton was right to call her out or actually was giving her unintentionally a platform. And almost immediately she bumped up in the polls from virtually 0 to 1% up to 4 or 5%. So, you know, here in New Hampshire in particular, her message, she's found a group of constituents that her message seems to resonate with. And so it's kept her in the conversation in a way that we might not have thought was possible a month or so ago.
Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, they're presenting themselves as the kind of more moderate Democrats in this campaign. Klobuchar, she filed her paperwork as well, I believe, this this week recently. She's referred to herself as the progressive who gets things done. Bennett warned about lurching too far to the left and losing this battle over Medicare for all. Paul, what do you make of these two candidates?
Yeah, Klobuchar especially. Bennett is a very long shot, let's be honest. He's not made the debate stage this autumn. But he, as you said, he's definitely one of the more centrist candidates, and he's been fiercely attacking Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders over Medicare for All. Klobuchar doing the same thing. She got a huge boost last month at that last Democratic presidential debate when she joined Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, in really going after Warren, especially on how she would pay for Medicare for All and the fact that it would replace millions of Americans would lose their insurance. She brought up those same arguments as she filed. I also asked her about Pete Buttigieg, who was kind of standing in front of her as she starts to move up. And she took a little jab at him as well, kind of talking about her experience and his lack of experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the biggest import in all of this, Klobuchar being more vocal for Democratic moderates, Pete Buttigieg kind of staking out that terrain as well, Michael Bennett for sure. That whole debate within the Democratic Party has become increasingly vocal. Moderates are speaking up a little bit more. There's some data that just came out, polling data that shows that in battleground states, moderate Democrats are looking for a different kind of candidate other than Warren or Sanders. So that intra-party battle between progressives and moderates is really starting to heat up. You know, we saw some news yesterday about former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg filing paperwork in Alabama, just because the filing deadline is coming up. That would be March 3rd, which is Super Tuesday, 16 states. So got his paperwork in for Alabama. Doesn't mean he's going to run for president, but the same kinds of rumblings on the one part of the party that the other side of the party has gone too far to the left, and that in some way would make a Democrat less viable against Donald Trump. So that debate is by no means over, but it's really finally bubbling to the surface, and Bennett and Klobuchar and Buttigieg and others are all part of that debate.
Paul, your thoughts on Michael Bloomberg, who's making people think, wow, this race could get bigger again.
This is a big story. Why? Michael Bloomberg has billions of dollars, and if he jumped in, he would be able to spend them immediately. It would almost dwarf what Tom Steyer has been doing. He's got millions of dollars, or a few billion. Bloomberg, I have some reporting. He reached out to our Democratic chair here, longtime Democratic State Party chair, Ray Buckley. So he and his organization have been reaching out in recent days to top Democrats here. He has 1 week now to decide if he's going to come up here. He filed for Alabama. That's fine. You got to do that because they're the first one to have a deadline. But more importantly, his R primary, he's got a week to decide. I've been reaching out to a bunch of his top aides saying, is he coming up here next week? They're being coy. They're not saying yes, but they're definitely not saying no. They have said they're going to make sure he has, they're not ruling anything out. So we could have a big surprise next week and see Michael Bloomberg up here.
And part of Bloomberg's concern, as it's being reported, is that his belief that Biden isn't quite doing the job for moderate Democrats in the party, that he's a little shaky as a front runner or a co-front runner, whichever you prefer, and that maybe he needs to get into the race as well. And then, other Democrats are saying, that he's worth billions of dollars. He instead of getting into the race, he could put that money towards some other candidates that he might favor. But actually, Tom Steyer could do the same thing, but they both, we don't know the Bloomberg's going to get in, but they're both focused more on their own candidacies.
And if he jumped in, I think it would be pretty clear his target would not be Joe Biden. His target would be Elizabeth Warren. He would go full force after her. And also, let's also be honest, there's no hunger right now for another billionaire to jump into the race. And I think the progressive wing of the party would not take it too kindly. So this is a fascinating story. And next week will be very telling.
And so before we get too far along, we have more Democrats to discuss. But I want to ask, Paul, any GOP candidates? I mean, there are some challengers to President Trump in the primary. Are any GOP challengers making the trip to New Hampshire this
week?
Yes,
all three will. They're all filing next week. That's the plan right now. They all remain very long shots against this president. New polling here in New Hampshire last week indicated that. But we should mention their names, of course. Bill Weld, the former Massachusetts governor, who's been up here virtually every week, guys, since he announced back in April. Also, Mark Sanford, the former South Carolina governor and congressman. And Joe Walsh, not the musician, no, the former Illinois congressman turned conservative radio talk show host.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're talking a little bit about 2020 candidates. It's still time for you to weigh in on that. If you'd like, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Who do you like? Who are you making the trip to see as they file their paperwork in Secretary of State Bill Gardner's office? Is there a candidate you are that fired up about that you will make that trip? Let us know. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We're also going to talk about municipal elections in just a little bit. Decisions made in certain towns about sports betting. Also, there were mayoral elections in several cities and towns across New Hampshire. We'll break some of those results down in just a little bit. But I wanted to talk about Andrew Yang, because this week Laura Kanoy and Josh Rogers hosted the latest in NHPR's Presidential Forum series with Andrew Yang. He was here yesterday. This was a collaboration with New Hampshire PBS. You can hear or watch that at nhpr.org. But we wanted to give you a little bit of what Andrew Yang had to say. Here is Yang responding to a listener question about whether his universal basic income idea, that's the idea where the government would give $1,000 a month to every American over age 18 who opts into the program. Here he is talking about whether or not that would lead to inflation.
For landlords, if you're living in a rental right now, you get an extra $1,000 a month, and then the landlord's like, ooh, I'm going to stick it to you. I'm going to like jack up your rent by, $600. Then the first thing you do is you look up and say, okay, like, let me see if other landlords are not going to try and gouge me. And then let's say every landlord tried to gouge you. If it reached that extreme, then you'd look around and say, well, there are four of us. We're getting $1,000 a month. With $4,000 a month, we can actually buy that fixer-upper, and then you can take upstairs, I'll take downstairs. This actually makes us harder to exploit and harder to push around for landlords or abusive employers. This improves our bargaining power because $1,000 a month is portable. it's passive. It goes with us wherever we want. And if they push too hard, then we can walk.
Andrew Yang explaining the inflation that he thinks, or the relationship between inflation and his $1,000 a month universal basic income plan. Again, that conversation with Andrew Yang you can watch tonight at 8:30 on New Hampshire PBS Explore. You can also find the full audio at nhpr.org. Paul, your thoughts on Andrew Yang and his campaigning through New Hampshire?
One of the most fascinating stories in this election cycle. I remember covering him the first time he came here to New Hampshire to Concord way back in March of last year. Nobody knew him. Nobody ever heard of him. But his campaign caught fire, mostly because of that universal basic income, that freedom dividend that he talks about constantly. That has really given him a lot of support among people who find it fascinating. And also, he is the anti-politician. He's got a lot of charisma. And we saw this spring and summer his campaign start to soar. Now he's making the debate stages when governors and senators couldn't make it. Today he files at the State House. He'll have a rally. Let's see how large it is. I bet it will be pretty large, pretty energetic.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, he's absolutely having a great time on the campaign trail. I think every interview I've seen with him, he seems almost surprised at how popular he's become as a candidate. That said, I still view him as a niche candidate. I don't see a path by which he would become the nominee, but he certainly has brought an interesting dimension to the debate. You know, I'm a little less optimistic about that logic that he described in the clip. You know, the people who are most in need of that $1,000 dividend are typically the least mobile individuals in a society, and they don't necessarily have the ability to shop around for apartments. They're often in difficult financial circumstances. So I understand the appeal of it, but my concerns about price gouging and inflation are a little bit less optimistic than Yang was there. But you know, he's going to be part of the conversation for a while. He's got enough interest and a big enough constituency that he can be part of the debates. He's polling. You know, he's not in the top four, but he pops up in the middle there somewhere, and that's not a bad place to be given where he started.
Final bits of news to talk about with respect to 2020 is that we learned that Julian Castro is closing up his New Hampshire operation. We also learned that the campaign for California Senator Kamala Harris is also moved to largely end her effort in New Hampshire by laying off the campaign's field organizers in the state. Paul, the beginning of the end for both of these candidates, or just they're going to focus their efforts elsewhere and play the long game?
No, never good signs. Listen, Harris's campaign was hemorrhaging campaign cash. She was spending more than she was bringing in. She wasn't resonating that well here. She peaked after that first debate this summer, both here and nationally, when she took out Joe Biden, but never really followed up with anything. Harris had always been, there were always questions about how much emphasis Harris would put here in New Hampshire. Now she doesn't have the ability to do that anymore, so she's concentrating on Iowa. They vote first. Same thing for Castro, though, to a lesser degree. He never has raised a lot of money. He's made the debate stages up until now, but just never was considered a top-tier candidate. He doesn't have the resources to continue here. He had a small staff here. Now it's been let go. They're both going to concentrate on Iowa.
All right. Well, let's shift a little bit downward to the local level. We had some elections this week here in New Hampshire to talk about. Paul, I want to ask you a little bit about this because you've been covering some of these. As for the mayoral elections, we had a few. We had the Laconia Keene, also Manchester, of course, the big one in Manchester. Tell us a little bit about how things played out in Manchester,
yeah,
Paul.
Joyce Craig did very well with 57% of the vote over Victoria Sullivan, which had 43%. The issues really came down to safety and quality of life. And it might have been considered a referendum on Craig and her progress. She certainly came in. She beat Mayor Gatsis before, and she may possibly be a future gubernatorial candidate. The Concord vote was not surprising. Jim Bolle got a seventh term, defeating Linda Ray Banfill. That was a 3,901 vote over 994. Mayor of Berlin, Paul Grenier, got a sixth term, mm-hmm. And he called that a mandate to work with the council and to deal with some of the major problems they have about finances there. He beat Richard LaFlamme 1077 to 547. And J. Stuart Stevens also ran with 115 votes. Pretty close race in Laconia, where former State Senator Andrew Hosmer won over Peter Spanos. Hosmer is a Democrat, and he got 1767 votes over Peter Spanos of 1478. So that was pretty close.
Yeah, and we had an opportunity to talk to Andrew Hosmer this week about what he plans to do once he takes the reins as mayor of Laconia. And here he is talking about how he plans to try to keep young people in Laconia. That was one of his campaign issues.
I think it has to do with the school system. The people that I came across when I was knocking on doors talked about they first sought a community to live in based on the quality of the education. So younger families with school-age children would first of all be drawn to high-quality education in a community. They would often, the secondary interest would be the housing or where they're going to live within a community. So the idea of focusing on education and improving our schools, that will drive the primary home market and allow us to develop more housing units. And when I think of housing units, I think of really solid middle-class housing units.
So that was Andrew Hosmer speaking about his priorities going forward once he takes the reins as mayor of Laconia. Paula, you mentioned that, you know, he was a Democrat, and that's true. But these mayoral elections, generally speaking, they're not partisan. But they're not.
Yeah. So it's really hard for anybody to sort of read the tea leaves on, you know, whether this was a big Republican turnout or a big Democratic turnout. But they do lean one way or the other. And obviously, Peter Spanos had more of the Republicans behind him. I just think that it is a very interesting situation in Laconia. I think that the housing situation is going to become a major issue as the governor is going to be putting forward some legislation on that subject. And the other races there was an upset in Dover where Mayor Karen Weston was defeated by Robert Carrier. And the city councilor, George Hansel, defeated Mitch Greenwald. Rochester had its first elected transgender city councilor in the state, which was pretty exciting for them. In Nashua, Jim Donches ran unopposed. He's a pretty well-known Democrat. So that sort of sums up where things stood. There was pretty good turnout, I think. But we'll see.
What is pretty good turnout overall? Is that, for an off year election?
Yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Typically off year elections are typically the lowest of turnout in terms of the three options: off year, midterm election, presidential year. My sense was from reading the coverage that turnout was up a bit. It's you have to be cautious about reading too much broad political import into these results. But there is this kind of partisan atmosphere that surrounds them, particularly the Manchester's mayor's race. That's really the biggest mayoral race in the state. That does have some of the trappings of Republicans against Democrats. Democrats are trying to capitalize on the results. They put out a press release or an email yesterday saying that they had won the vast majority of contests and that Democratic turnout was way up. And, those are little seeds you can kind of look at to plant for a presidential year. But, a lot of these municipal elections, people are just kind of, do they like the way their town feels, or their municipal facilities doing okay? And that's why you get some of these folks like, Jim Boulay here in Concord, who got elected to a seventh term. That may be the most that anyone's ever gotten in Concord. But, just an example of where, there's sometimes partisanship is kind of in the room, but not in the way that you would see it a midterm or a general. But yeah, I think turnout was up. Typically, for these kinds of off years, you're looking at under 20%. And I think this was a little bit higher this time.
Paul Steinhauser.
Democrats make this analogy. They look back to the 2017 off-year elections and those special elections where they did very well, and that led to a big Democratic wave here in New Hampshire and nationally in 2018. So they feel good about 2020. Republicans, Governor Kristi Noonan talking to my colleague at the Monitor, Ethan DeWitt, and other reporters yesterday, and saying that actually, if you look at some of the other elections, Republicans did very well. They point to Manchester, where Republicans made gains on the Board of Aldermen and on the school election, school board as well. They point to Keene, with now a Republican mayor, who I know in his conversation with you said it was had nothing to do with partisanship.
He said he rejected any kind of help from the state, and he did a lot of individual campaigning, and also there were four other city councilors in Keene who are going to join, and it's going to be a little bit younger, apparently, in Keene going forward, according to George Hansel. But yeah, it seems like the parties are looking for something to say
exactly
about this, and so they're reaching not too far, but it's there. there's something there. And I've heard some chatter online that says, okay, you know, Democrats made gains in 2017. They made gains in 2018. Now they're apparently saying they made gains in 2019. They're looking for a 4-for-4 in 2020. Yes. Somehow making these mayoral elections about the presidential race. If you can believe it.
Now, the state elections, they had their big moment this week, the local elections. That's kind of going to dissipate now. It's all going to be about the 2020 presidential primary, at least through February 11th. And then after that's over here in New Hampshire, we'll get back to really concentrating on the Senate race, the governor's race, the down-ballot races.
There's so much to talk about. One more thing to talk about this week's elections, the sports betting. That was on the ballot. Paula, some cities said yes, some cities said no thanks.
Yeah, it won in 5 out of 9 cities. It won in Manchester, Berlin, Claremont, Laconia, and Somersworth. Franklin previously voted it in 2 on October 1st, but no in Nashua, Concord, and Rochester. You know, the money that comes through the Lottery Commission in these things has generated $2 billion for education since 1964, and many feel that this sports gambling, this is a big phenomenon that's going on across the country, will be a big boom for education, but that has yet to be seen. Keno was keyed up as this big thing and hasn't turned out.
It's supposed to be for full-day kindergarten, then lawmakers went back and said, nah, we don't need to put it exactly for just kindergarten.
So the Keno 603, you know, it was rejected in Concord, Portsmouth, and Keene, and approved in Rochester and Dover. But there's many localities that will vote on this at town meeting, the Keno 603 coming up in the spring or March.
And the state wants the 10 sports betting locations at least to start. Mm-hmm. So it could be distributed among those communities that voted yes this
right.
week.
It's still up to them to decide whether these will go. But at least the Lottery Commission now knows where and who wants it and who doesn't want it. Mm-hmm.
And the commission still says they want $10 million out of this, right?
Right.
And they still think they're going to get it no matter where they are. They could be doubling up in some cities if possible.
There was an interesting article in the Boston Globe over the weekend. It was just a small little piece about DraftKings. And DraftKings has been what the state lottery commission is saying is now likely.
I have been working on
the likely designee for the contract, and that it has become so popular that it is likely going to be picked up by an investment firm. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not, but and how that might play into the state choosing them as a partner. So that's all coming up.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, legislature is not officially in session, but committees are discussing what legislation they'd like to put before all legislators. Paula Tracy will stay with us to talk about that. But we want to thank Paul Steinhauser, political reporter, for being on the program today. Thanks very much, Paul. And what will you be following next week?
Last week of filing, Elizabeth Warren will be doing it on Wednesday, Tom Steyer Tuesday, Cory Booker Friday, and Ted Cruz is coming back to the state as well.
All right.
Not to file, though.
Not to file. All right. Well, you'll be telling us what he's here for, I hope. Paul, thanks very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are taking a fresh look at the events of the past week with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Paula Tracy, senior reporter covering the State House and environmental issues for InDepthNH.org. So let's talk about some State House issues, Paula. You've been pretty much camped out at the State House recently. Lots going on these days, even though the legislature is not in session yet. Lots of committees working through some legislative service requests, another hangover legislation that didn't quite make it last time around. How consequential are these meetings this week?
Well, I think it'll be interesting. We'll find out on January 8th when the legislature comes back in a session and deals with these 156 retained bills from the House last session. They have a deadline of next Thursday to get those all reported out of committee. And a number of them are morphing into some substantial legislation. I was at the State House this week to hear a bill which started out as enabling legislation for cities and towns to deal with single-use plastic bags. And an amendment came in, which was passed, which would make a 10-cent fee required at all grocery stores and retail outlets for single-use carry-out bags. It is not supported at all by the Republicans, but it passed in the House Municipal and County Government Committee on partisan lines. Representative Marjorie Porter explained that this time of year is to deal with the tricky bills, the ones that need work or not quite ready for prime time. She said maybe they're a little controversial or we need to wait for results of court cases, but they can be killed, amended, or sent to interim study. Interestingly, I didn't know this, but the legislature cannot re-refer bills to the next legislature when they can do this right now when they're in their in the middle of their session, but they cannot do it and bind the next legislature. So this is an opportunity for them to try to get some of the things done that they wanted to get done, but they're going to have to come up against the same veto situation. And you know, if the Republicans are dead set against this bag, it's, you know, it's an indication that we might be doing Groundhog Day all over again.
Dean.
Yeah, this the plastic bag legislation is really interesting. This is something that is getting a lot of traction around the country. You know, places like California, Maine, and Vermont already do it. There are some other states as well. You also see different cities and municipalities deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Some outright banning of plastic bags, outright banning of styrofoam containers, things like that. This particular bill would be a uniform statewide piece of legislation. The New Hampshire Grocers Association, the group that represents grocers and legislative interests, they oppose it. I don't know where Governor Sununu is on this, but it's not particularly popular with Republicans. So this is something that's just going to keep coming up. It's getting more and more traction among people who are focused on environmental concerns and conditions. The other interesting issue, and I'm sure Paula can talk about this as well, is the Medicaid work requirements. You recall back when the legislature agreed to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, Republicans insisted on a work requirement. That has since ended up in the courts. It's been problematic in a number of other states. And it affects about 25,000 people here in New Hampshire.
And now the House Health and Human Services Committee is calling for the repeal
just
of
to
the
repeal
requirement.
Them, right? And so, and this is something my guess is that Governor Sununu would oppose. So, as Paula said, you know, these as long as we have a split government with a governor of one party and a legislature of the other party, you're going to keep seeing us cycling through these kinds of issues as you know, one side passes it and then the governor vetoes it or vice versa.
Another thing that's happening this time of year is there are over 200 active statutory commissions in the state, and a number of them have November deadlines. Probably about a quarter of them have deadlines to report suggested legislation for the next session. We're waiting to hear on issues from school funding, the school funding one is just beginning because that was part of the budget. And we're going to go back and talk about how the state funds education. They have not yet selected people to be on that, but that's going to be going forward. But there are mental health and wellness programs, grand families. There's statutory commissions on wake boats, snowmobile access, shoreline septic, drinking water safety, drug costs, and barriers to the increased density of land for workforce housing. That's going to be an issue that will definitely be coming up new. And then it's also time for, we've already passed the deadline for bills to be, and there's almost 700 or 800. So legislators are down there getting co-sponsors, working on the fine-tuning of their bills. And then Sununu is putting forth a number of plans on legislation he wants. And he's already said he wants a bill on affordable housing, another one on family leave. And he's in the past said he would work to push forward legislative matters on bail reform and college debt assistance.
Things that many people are calling for, many stripes. So one of the other things you covered this week, Paula, you covered the Executive Council and the discussion about the Merrimack tolls. Now, here is Democratic Executive Counselor Deb Pignatelli talking about her efforts to eliminate the Merrimack toll tax.
I have been working on this since I first joined the council in 2004. Matter of fact, it was my part-time job between 2004 and 2010, and have had many ideas, but this is the first time I've had three councilors. I can count to three, and needed three councilors to pass this. So I am really pleased for the Merrimack folks. I think it's a real win for them.
So this gets politically complicated, Paula.
Yes.
Can you explain to us why?
Well, the governor also supports the elimination of the tolls. What happened was a couple weeks ago at the Executive Council, the Councilor Pignatelli confronted the governor about an incident in her district where the governor was asked about the tolls. And he said, go talk to Deb. Deb's all for raising tolls. Good luck trying to get Deb to get rid of your tolls. Really, you should talk to her. She's been ignoring me since she got in. Well, she didn't like that very much. And he said that she was misinformed on how he characterized it, and that he told the folks that it was, in fact, the Executive Council that had the authority to raise and lower. So what happened this week was the GACIT met, and that is an advisory commission to the Department of Transportation on the 10-year highway plan. And they voted 4-1 to zero out the tolls at Merrimack as of the 1st of July, where they're hoping that the governor will put it on next the next agenda, because he has control over that. But it seems like he probably will do that, because he put out a press release saying that he was all for it.
So they can bring the tolls down to zero, but not necessarily
remove
all the infrastructure.
They're not going to remove them. That would be expensive.
Yeah.
The 4-1 vote was Mike Kryans voted against it because he felt that the timing needed to be such that the Department of Transportation was able to relocate these workers and that there was too quick a time frame for it. But he might still support it if the transportation folks think as they can that they can move these workers to neighboring tolls. But after the council meeting, Executive Councilor Andrew Valinsky, who's running also for governor as a Democrat, accused Sununu of not being truthful in the remarks he made alleging that Pignatelli was raising the tolls. He accused the governor of misleading the council and bad-mouthing Pignatelli. And he said the governor had the audacity to issue a press release just to get ahead of the parade that had already left. And he added that he doesn't like calling anyone a liar, but facts are facts. The governor's office responded by stating that Pignatelli voted to raise the tolls in 2007. That was a uniform. It wasn't just specific to Merrimack. But it got pretty heated. And I think as the issue goes forward, they agree on this. So I'm not sure how difficult it will be. But I think that it's likely that Merrimack drivers will not have a toll.
It seems like tensions are pretty high between the parties at the Statehouse right now, Paula. And one other facet of that tension is centered around Representative Tamara Lee, a Democrat from New Hampton. She's been suspended from her assignment on the House Education Committee after saying in a post on Facebook, F private and religious schools. The language, of course, much stronger, but this is radio. Why did she say that?
She was talking about private and religious education and schools, and her Facebook page would seem to indicate that she opposes public funding for such efforts. Apparently, the Speaker Shurtleff gave her a warning and suspended her, did not totally eliminate her. So she'll be able to get back and vote on issues in the Education Committee probably in about February. But he did strip Representative John Burt of Goffstown, a Republican, of his seat on the House Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. We had a story on that Thursday. He's a big gun rights advocate, and he has been posting also on social media, his Facebook account, related to the decision to not offer Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando another term in that position. And he has been celebrating that. Apparently, on his Facebook page, it shows that he had been brought to the office of Speaker Shurtleff, and who he said had a nice talk, and that he wanted to meet with him regarding his postings on Normando, and those postings have said that he would not support, and he didn't want the governor to support anybody who is not 100% committed to gun rights, and he charged that Normando has not, It seems likely that what's happening is the Republicans the leader of the Republican Party, Dick Hinch of Merrimack, he issued a statement saying it was a double standard to just suspend Leigh from her education and totally cut Burt out, noting that there's 9 big gun bills that are coming before that committee. And Burt seriously wants to be there to make his point that we don't need any more gun laws in the state.
So will Burt be replaced by another Republican?
It's not clear.
It's not clear.
Nor whether he will be reassigned to another committee. It just happened yesterday, and they're still talking behind the scenes, but what Shurtleff is saying is that it isn't a double standard, because he already had warned Burt not to do this. And so it's like 2 strikes, you're out, and Leigh only has 1 strike right now.
Okay, and her, I guess the suspension would be her first strike. Okay, according to,
yes.
What the powers that be. All right. Yes. We got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk to NHPR Sarah Gibson about a variety of education-related issues, including the story that 2 top administrators in Concord school system have now resigned. And that follows allegations that the district did not handle appropriately allegations of sexual misconduct by a former teacher. We'll talk about that story. If you have questions or comments about the week's news, now's the time to send us an email. And the address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, where you can watch a live video of this radio broadcast. Just go to Facebook and search for us by using NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Paula Tracy, senior reporter covering state house and environmental issues for InDepthNH.org, and joining us for this part of the program is Sarah Gibson, NHPR Southern New Hampshire and education reporter. Sarah, thank you for being on the show today. Really
Thanks
appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Concord schools, because big news this week. Concord school superintendent Terry Forston resigned last week. And then 3 days later, on Monday, we learned Concord High School principal Tom Sicca resigned. This is part of the fallout from allegations of sexual assault by a former teacher in the Concord school system, Howie Leung. Sarah, bring us up to speed on this story. What happened with Howie Leung?
Well, there's going to be a trial about that next year. But basically, the allegations are that he actually is facing charges, that he very serious felony charges, that he sexually assaulted a Concord student. And there were a couple of concerns that had been raised earlier on about his behavior, his kind of intimate relationships. He seemed to have very close relationships with students, not just his special ed students. He was a special ed teacher, but also just others who were in clubs, both in the middle school and in the high school, where he eventually was working by 2019 when he was fired. So the concerns that revolve around Tom Sicca, who just recently resigned, were that he had actually suspended a student when she had come and raised issues, concerns she had about Howie Leung years and years ago. And also that when additional concerns were raised more recently, about a year ago, he did not, people say, act fast enough. And in fact, Howie Leung continued to teach at Concord High School for months and months after some concerns had been raised, and both the DOE and police and the Concord School District were looking into his behavior.
And a group of parents has been particularly vocal about making sure that there is some accountability at the top. Have representatives from this group said anything publicly about the resignations of Forston and Sicca?
So this is a group that's a very diverse group. Many, many community members, many parents, many students have been airing their concerns and making requests of the district for sharing information. So there's no one representative saying, yes, we approve of what the school board did. No, we don't. However, that group has shared a really lengthy set of questions, pages and pages upon questions, to both with myself and with the school board, saying we have tons of questions about how much you knew, how much other administrators knew, and kind of what the timeline was for this misconduct, this alleged misconduct. And so certainly those questions have not all been answered. A couple of them were answered on Monday night at the school board meeting. But at that school board meeting, the school board chair did say, you know, we see there are lots more questions. We'll try to get to some more of those. However, a lot of these questions, I believe, will not be answered because they relate to issues that the school board has said are confidential.
And the report that came out of this, right? The school board commissioned a report to really look into this, but the report will not be made public, right? It's because they just can't. They say that they can't even redact anything without having some kind of either HR information or student information compromised.
Exactly. So as listeners might recall, there are two things we're talking about. There's an investigation that was commissioned, and then there's also a set of recommendations. That set of recommendations by the same investigator have been shared. They were shared last week. And people can go online to get a link of that on HPR.org. But they're pretty broad. But the investigation itself, the board members had said, we're going to try to share aspects of that investigation once we read through it and once we figure out what can be kept confidential, what can be made public. And it turns out they said on Monday night, look, we even with redacted names, there's so many details here that are going to jog people's memory because there's been so many conversations publicly, so much reporting about what's happened, that we really cannot trust that even a redacted copy would protect the identities, particularly of students, but also of staff members.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, you know, as a parent of a former Concord student, I'm familiar with all these folks and I've been watching it very closely. It's really roiled the community in many respects. For those of us who have kind of watched the situation closely and know the key players, I think that the writing was on the wall for a long time. If you'd asked me in the summer, I would have said that there's no way that Principal Sicca or the Superintendent Forston would still be in their positions in 2020. It was clear that they were going to have to go. And as Sarah just said, one of the big problems has been the flow of information and who knew what when. The most recent example was there was some email threads that showed that Principal Sicca had actually been fairly involved on a regular basis in some of the decision-making on the high school, even though he was supposed to be on paid leave, and that was upsetting to parents. And the issue is what can the board disclose? And, there's independent investigator who did this report, and there, for all the reasons we've discussed, a lot of it is has to be redacted or just can't be released. And there have been other, we've talked on the roundup before about other similar sorts of problems in the Concord school system, at the high school in particular, in recent years. So the whole thing has kind of had a peel back the onion quality to it that I think has been very frustrating for parents. And when your children are involved, I speak from experience, their emotions tend to run high, and people are with good reason very upset about this. But it sounds like they're now slowly but surely getting onto a course where they can move forward with some new policies and programs in place.
And I do want to note that Terry Forston resigned on Friday. We got news of her resignation. It appears that the school board, after having read through the investigation, very soon after voted to terminate Sicca. And then there were negotiations, et cetera. And then he issued his resignation later on. So it could be that they knew for a while, Sicca was not going to be around, but we're not able to make that public until this past Monday. And I also think, there's been so much scrutiny on the Concord School District for good reason, and a lot of mobilizing by parents, as Dean was saying. It's terrifying to imagine that your kid is in a school that's not safe, where really awful things are happening. However, I've talked to teachers and administrators at other districts who say, look, we don't have 100% foolproof and perfect policy ourselves. I mean, it does really seem, I think this really begs questions of other districts as well and of the state at large of, you know, how districts are prepared to deal with this so that we don't get to this point where revelations are made, you know, a year afterwards about really serious, terrible behavior by an educator.
Other stories.
Again, alleged behavior, but I will say that even though we're talking about allegations, the narrative in Concord is that this did occur, and I think the level of kind of mobilizing and action by parents is assuming that these events did occur.
Mm-hmm. Other stories that the NHPR newsroom has been following this week. The federal government is announcing $12 million to build a new bridge on Route 119 connecting Hinsdale and Brattleboro, Vermont. There are currently two separate bridges connecting on an island in the Connecticut River, and the spans are on the state's red list of bridges in need of work. The total cost of the project is $50 million. Also, Dartmouth College announced it will start tests next week to determine the viability of using geo-exchange heating and cooling systems at two locations on campus. The college is currently exploring new types of energy it could use to heat the campus as it tries to move away from burning fossil fuels. And the Attorney General's office says state and local officials are investigating what they call a, quote, officer-involved incident that happened last night in Ossipee. The office released a statement saying no officers have been physically injured and there's no threat to the public. It says additional information will be released as it becomes available. Police responded to what was described as a standoff. Sarah Gibson, you mentioned just a moment ago how awful it must be for parents to think about how unsafe their kids might be in school. You also reported this week on the safety of educators in school. And there was a report to that effect talking about how we don't quite know as much as we need to know or like to know about incidents of violence or incidents where when teachers are harmed in the classroom. Why don't we know as much as we'd like to know?
There are a lot of reasons for that, Peter. But so what we're talking about here is a school violence study committee that got together earlier in the fall because of a Senate bill. And basically, the lawmakers brought in people from the DOL, people from the DOE, educators, administrators, to figure out what's going on with the fact that, at least according to the DOL data, there are way more student-inflicted teacher injuries being reported. In fact, twice as many as we saw a couple of years ago. And many people say this is kind of the new frontier almost of thinking about school safety. So we think about, you know, being prepared for an active shooter, unfortunately. Those are things we have to think about. Bullying, student-on-student violence, but there's also sometimes very unintentional violence. But it's being considered violence. It's being called injuries if, say, a student is out of control and they bite a teacher, or a student threatens a teacher, or a student has a meltdown and in the process of that injures their teacher who's trying to calm them down. So there are different ways of making those reports of those incidents to the DOL than making those to the DOE. They have kind of different standards of what you're supposed to report, and that means the state right now has pretty much no good data on how frequently teachers and paraeducators are being injured by students.
So going forward, the recommendation is to unify those two ways of reporting to the DOE and the DOL?
Yeah, to standardize the reporting, to kind of make the DOE and DOL talk to each other, and also, to ensure that there are, in fact, if a district is, say, intimidating teachers or discouraging teachers from making those reports because it doesn't look great if your teachers are getting injured, that there are some repercussions for that district. So I think we'll see a couple bills related to this in the coming year. And I think educators are definitely feeling encouraged by the fact that this is being looked at more seriously.
Okay, lots of heavy news this week. I want to end the show on a happy story.
Ooh.
So the happy story is the animal story for this week. Okay.
Great.
So in the Union Leader this week, it was reported that a couple in Plastow kept hearing the sounds of what they thought was an owl near their home. They looked around, they looked in their attic, they couldn't find anything, but they kept hearing the sound. And then they thought to look in their chimney. And there it was, a barred owl that apparently been stuck in the chimney for several days. So they called the Plastow Animal Control, pulled the owl out alive, and then they let it loose outside. It just flew away. And I guess the takeaway for this couple was install a cap on your chimney so the wildlife doesn't get in. So happy story. They all got away. Owl must have been pretty healthy even after several days in the chimney.
Maybe it found like mice and stuff in the chimney.
Who knows? Maybe squirrels had been dropping acorns in there and owls suddenly eat acorns. I don't know. Anybody here ever get like some kind of wildlife in your chimney?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. We used to have bats come in my chimney. I mean, this very tiny little mountain town in Vermont. The bats love coming into the chimney. Checking things out. It's really hard to get a bat out of your house, it turns out.
Agreed. I had a bat in my bedroom once, and it was a terrifying experience. And the dog was no help. The dog was just watching as the owls.
Well, they don't fly.
Yes, the bat. Well, you think
squirrels can fly. And we've had flying squirrels in our house. And, you know, creatures are part of living in New Hampshire, and that's one of the fun and exciting parts. And it just fortunately, this barred owl was able to get out with some help, and I love critter stories. They're the best part of
it. It's my favorite part of the show, I think. I mean, I love the show, but like animal stories, favorite part. And also, Union Leader has a really cute picture of the owl.
Oh, good.
If anybody is interested. Yeah. So, cool story by Jason Schreiber of the Union Leader. Okay, we have to wrap up, but I want to thank you all for being on the program today. NHPR Sarah Gibson, Southern New Hampshire, an education reporter. Paula Tracy, senior reporter covering state house and environmental issues for InDepthNH.org. And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being on the program today. We appreciate your insights.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
You're welcome.
And remember, listeners, the conversation about everything we talked about today, including that owl, continues at nhpr.org or on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producers, Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Rebecca Lavoie was operating the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.